Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to this program. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour, the most downloaded, listened-to radio program in the United States. We want to thank the 227,000 people who downloaded our program here on this network, and we're adding about 1,347,000 new, younger listeners just on the Internet alone in the last 12 months, adding to all the people already listening. This program is different than the other almost 20 hours of broadcasting I do a week. On our sister stations, KPFK in Los Angeles, PFW in Washington, BAI in New York, and of course across all the other stations around the United States. This is a single issue. We do not limit the time, and we give our guests, who are experts in their field, unlimited amount of opportunity to discuss the issue in depth without interruption. Today, a special look at the Federal Reserve. My guest, there will be two, Professor William Black from Kansas City. Professor Black is an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, where he specializes in financial fraud, white-collar crime, public finance, antitrust, and Latin American development. Previously, he was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention, as well as teaching at the University of Texas at Austin. He was the litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and served as the deputy director of the National Commission on Financial Institution Reform. He was a key player in exposing the Keating Five during the savings loan scandals, and in 2010 testified before Congress about the role of all of this in our current financial climate. Joining him today, and his website is truthaccounting.org. truthaccounting.org. He is also the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, How Corporate Executives and Politicians Looted the SNL Industry. He will be joined by William Bergman. William Bergman earned an MBA and another master's in public policy from the University of Chicago. He worked as an economist and financial markets policy analyst for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago for 14 years, where his work included writing the Chicago Fed's contribution to the Federal Reserve Beige Book, the implications national emergency powers hold for Federal Reserve independence, and critical analysis of the role of credit ratings in capital regulation. Also, the Fed's pricing of its $1 trillion a day Fedwire, interbank payment service, and a project in the money laundering area. He has also worked in the private sector, stock market, research in that area, and he is currently working with the Institute for Truth in Accounting, developing a database of state economic and demographic information in an effort to advance truthful government accounting practices. He is the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
As you may know, this is the one program on the radio where we do not have a chit-chat. It is not a banter. Instead, it's a classroom on the air where you're given unlimited amounts of time to explore an issue, so you're not rushed. There's no need for a fast or quick answer, a news bite answer. So take your time much as you would if you were giving a lecture in your classrooms, all right?
Okay.
William Black, we're going to begin with you. First, let us begin with the basics. A lot of people do not understand the Federal Reserve. Is it federal? Is it private? It is some morph combination of the two. So clear up the confusion in many people's mind that the Federal Reserve is strictly a private entity comprised of private bank representatives and interest. Tell us what we need to know about what it actually is and how it actually functions.
Well, people mean different things when they say those words, and that's a large part of the confusion. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve is a federal agency. It's a federal agency that is an independent agency, which is not all that unusual. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, Federal Home Loan Bank Board, when they existed, these were all independent regulatory agencies. The people who work there are federal employees, and the leadership is appointed by the President of the United States with the advice and consent of the Senate. But the Federal Reserve System includes the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, which were somewhat analogous to the 12 federal home loan banks that used to have a mixed private and public purpose, which was ended by the 1989 legislation, FERIA, that came out of the savings and loan crisis. No such legislation has been passed in the Federal Reserve System context, so the Federal Reserve banks continue to have some mixture of private and public instrumentalities. They have leadership at the board of directors level that is primarily elected by the banks that the Federal Reserve banks are supposed to regulate, although theoretically the supervision is not within the purview of those boards of directors.
Who are the primary owners of the 12 regional Fed banks? Individuals, trusts, who actually has a stake? And who are the major players?
Which of us are you asking?
These are all your questions for right now.
Okay. The primary ownership, as with the Federal Home Loan Bank System, is with the member banks, and they elect the most of the board's members of the board of directors. There are different classes of board members. Some of them are designated as public interest, but that would probably sound like a sick joke to many people, because some of them are senior financial institution leaders within the purview of the Federal Reserve banks. So they have different functions. And some of these functions are governmental, and some of these functions are more commercial. And theoretically, the board of directors is supposed to be dealing with oversight of the commercial and not the governmental functions. Let me give you examples. So the Federal Reserve banks make loans to member institutions. That is mostly thought of as a commercial activity, and it certainly was in the Federal Home Loan Bank System. And the board of directors actively serve like a regular board of directors on those kinds of decisions. The Federal Reserve banks, though, also, as again the Federal Home Loan Banks did until the 1989 legislation, serve as the primary regulators of banks. And this means that the great bulk of the supervisory personnel, both the examiners who find the facts and the supervisors who give orders based on those facts, are based in the field, and most supervisory actions are taken in the field under delegated authority from the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, which again is the federal and governmental portion of it. The Board of Directors of the Federal Reserve banks are not supposed to have any role in those supervisory and examination decisions. And that's where some of the controversy comes in. I can tell you, in the Federal Home Loan Bank System, that some of the Federal Home Loan Banks, that rule, while they had the same rule, was not honored all the time in practice. In other words, the members of the board, elected by the industry, would attempt to influence supervisory decisions. And whether or not they directly sought to influence, it was thought, and I think correctly, that this is an inherent conflict of interest and a bad institutional structure. But it is the structure we have. There, your listeners might be interested in reading the document that the longtime head of supervision for the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve provided to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, in which he discussed some of this tension between the federal and the Federal Reserve Bank role in supervision. He said that he did not see evidence of the board's interfering with the regulatory decisions, but he also said that in his experience, the regional banks, the Federal Reserve banks, or 12 of them, tended to be consistently weaker on supervisory issues than the national supervisors would have preferred. And while he didn't say it, certainly the implication was it's their proximity to the industry. It's the fact that they know the industry sits on the board and such that would lead to this consistent tendency to be weaker on supervisory matters. Now, that's the opinion of one person, but it was the opinion of one very senior person who dealt with these issues for 20 years.
Okay. Please hold your thoughts. We're going to come back with you in a moment. Let's go over now and say hello to William Bergen. Mr. Bergman's website is truthinaccounting.org. Mr. Bergman, you worked at a Federal Reserve Bank. When you take a look at the larger picture, I'd like for you to address this in any way you wish. I'm concerned that if these are supposed to be the best and brightest economists, futurists, in planning the financial stability of our country, in effect, how is it that they missed the dot-com bubble? How is it they missed the subprime bubble? How is it that they seem to be missing all of these major catastrophes, taking no responsibility for them, and yet they're continuing to be the most powerful senior financial directors in the United States because they hold the purse strings. They print the money. Your thoughts?
Well, I think you're right to be exercised and concerned about that problem. Stepping back just for a moment, I think it's worthy of considering that we as a people have decided to have a law through our Congress that directs 12 people on the FOMC to control the aggregate amount of money and credit of over 300 million other people. And the degree of centralization of authority there is pretty dramatic, and one that in practice, whether or not, let's assume for the moment that those 12 people are well-intentioned, that they're not corrupted, that they're not taken over by special interest groups, even if those 12 people can actually do something that's that extraordinary and do it well is a very good question. And I think it's also worth noting that going back in time a little bit, my favorite single course at the Federal Reserve at the University of Chicago was a course taught by a fellow named Sam Peltzman, who introduced us to the work of George Stigler and learning about the University of Chicago's take on regulation. I think there's some important lessons there to answer your question. George Stigler was a wonderful Nobel Prize-winning economist, and one that the University of Chicago's take on regulation is something that, in fact, I think a progressive audience could actually enjoy learning about. Their concern at the Stigler School and the other people that like him, like Sam Peltzman, was that at the end of the day, the regulators tend to be captured by special interest groups and effectively captured by the industries that they're regulating. So as a consequence, first of all, we're asking the Federal Reserve to do very difficult things, and it's possible also that, like many other industries, the regulators tend to be captured by the people making money on the upside. And so I think that's another possible, you know, what is intent is an important question. But I'm afraid that we allowed way too much regulatory to be placed in the hands of people who are serving the people that were making money on the upside. And we can talk about moral hazard and some other reasons that are operating here, why the upside was so beneficial for the well-connected people, and you and I as taxpayers and citizens are paying the price on the downside.
Okay. Let's explore a few more with you on this issue. Some of my concerns, and I know people in this audience's concerns, and Michael Hudson, and many of the people that we have regularly on this program. We have now a quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3, but there was actually a fourth. You're both aware of it. And that's where, and we would never have known this, had it not been for the persistence of Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders, from the independent from Vermont, and getting a majority in the House to support a bill to audit the Fed. There were 22,000 transactions that allowed $16.3 trillion to go from the Fed to 20 different corporations, mainly banks, in the United States and in Europe, and France and Germany and other banks, at effectively zero interest, 0.2% interest. Those have not been paid back. Those banks are now sitting on a lot of capital. I looked at the amounts, $2.3 trillion for Citibank and $2.1 trillion for Bank of America, $840 billion for Goldman Sachs. And yet at no time in Congress, at least to my knowledge, where there were any hearings or open discussion about how that money was going to be spent, what was it being spent on, why was it being given, what would that do for the rest of the world to make it a better place. So how is it that in no discussions are we talking about that debt, because the American public is ultimately responsible, unless we just have fiat currency and nobody really cares how much money we print and give. But why isn't that that is never discussed anywhere in the media, and yet it's an absolute reality? Your thoughts?
Well, I believe the $16 trillion, a fair amount of that, in fact, has been paid back. But, you know, the broader consequences, the Federal Reserve in its defense will say that had we not done this, the systemic risk in the banking system is something that we could have ended up with something akin to what happened during the Great Depression. Had we
they,
not
they can't
done,
prove that. That's they cannot prove that. That is their lie that they tell us. Would you deconstruct their argument that without holding them up and giving them constant amounts of money into the trillions of dollars, that the entire economy would have collapsed? Which side would you defend on that?
Well, it's my belief that we could have withstood, it would have been painful, but we could have withstood a more market-oriented resolution of the crisis and allowing the creditors, for instance, of AIG and others to take the pain that they should have taken because they made mistakes in lending money on that score and in that volume. But having said that, that's my own personal opinion, and again, I can't prove that either. And more importantly, I think the more important question is, how do we get here in the first place? How do we let ourselves be exposed to the potential of a cataclysm when it was, and it was certainly a potential for a significant problem along those lines? The dollar amounts involved were massive. And that's where we get into some of the more interesting issues, I think, that Professor Black was identifying in terms of the conflicts of interest and other things operating in the regulatory apparatus. How did we let the situation threaten us in the first place? And as opposed to trying to argue about things we probably can't decide, it's more important, and I think very important, to critically question how we got here in the first place.
I would agree with that. Before we go back to Professor Black, would you address that? And then I'll ask him to address the same issue.
Well, I'm afraid that the banking regulators and in fact Congress, you and I as citizens, too, have a responsibility here in the fact that, you know, effectively, there's a concept in the insurance world called moral hazard, where if an insurance company extends an insurance policy, it knows that there's some more risk-taking potentially being taken by the person being insured. And it prices the policy and has other monitoring techniques to try to reduce the costs of, you know, there's a realization on the part of insurance companies that once they insure people, people take more risk. Well, you and I as citizens, through our Congress, have effectively provided a massive amount of insurance to our financial system, which in turn has used it extensively to make money on its own and then threaten us with the downside when the downside arises. And it has arisen in spades in recent years. And you and I maybe should be looking at the mirror, too, and defending, you know, there's efforts, for instance, there's a wonderful group in Washington called the Government Accountability Project, which has been promoting efforts to provide greater protection for whistleblowers within banking firms and banking regulators. And to what extent we really are reaping what we sowed by not monitoring our own Congress and our own regulators it's not necessarily just their fault, but I certainly think we need some more investigation, including a further audit of the Federal Reserve, which is a longer topic.
One more question before we go over to Professor Black. There were several investigative reporting articles that were not distributed by the mainstream media, but done by some respected journalists that show that just before 9/11, there were some extraordinary trades that were done, some that were so extraordinary that they represented the top three. They were in the top three trades in their category since 1947. There was a legitimate need then for us to explore that afterwards and to say, were these legitimate or not? Was there any insider trading? If so, then someone would have had a pre-knowledge of what was going to happen. Because we never knew the final outcome, we will never know the truth of this. You had wanted to do some research in this, and actually, I believe, had started, but I don't know what the outcome was. Would you bring us up to date of what happened when there was an attempt to do some research into this area?
I was invited in my last project at the Federal Reserve after, well, during 2001, I developed a paper exploring the implications of what happens during a declared national emergency or a time of war for the independence of the Federal Reserve system within the overall government. It's a very interesting topic all by itself, but once you throw this constitutional law area called national emergency powers, what happens in a declared national emergency, you can see extraordinary authority flow to the president during a time of crisis, and whether or not that's something that leads to a constitutional conflict between Congress and the executive branch. Well, I was about 80% finished with that paper in August 2001, and I ended up, well, I had some nice feedback from a senior constitutional law scholar and presented that paper at the Library of Congress in November 2001. Later on, in 2003 or so, after I did an update of that paper, I was invited to work in the money laundering area, and I was asked to develop a reference document for the Federal Reserve System if it was good, and the first thing I tried to write was a primer on money laundering for myself and anyone else new to the area, and I noticed two things. On August 2, 2001, the Board of Governors in Washington issued a non-routine letter to the Reserve Banks urging them to scrutinize suspicious activity reports. This letter didn't mention terrorism or its financing, but they were known to be part of the realm of suspicious activities. In addition, August 2001, there was an extraordinary surge in currency shipments. It was the third fastest growing month in the currency component of M1 since World War II. And I'd seen those two things and had some very good questions, I think, about how they should be investigated. And I was asked to go ahead and answer a question I'd raised, so I called board staff in Washington and asked the question. A week later, my assignment was terminated. I was told I committed an egregious breach of protocol, and a month later, my position at the bank was eliminated. But there are some good questions still outstanding on how those extraordinary currency shipments, billions of dollars, $100 bills above normal, may have both innocent as well as not innocent explanations relating to the events of 9/11.
So we have a big question mark, but even greater question mark is that if the Federal Reserve truly wanted the truth on this matter, and knowing that you were a scholar in the area and diligent and methodical in your scholarship, they should have encouraged you to find the truth, not fired you.
Well, it's possible that they're behind the scenes that it's been investigated honestly and found to be innocent.
But you don't know that. We don't know that.
We don't have any evidence that that's true.
Okay, so, but it's a big question mark, and I'm concerned about that. Hold your thoughts, please. We're going to come back to you. Let's go back to Professor Black. Professor Black, now I'm going to ask you questions that are not based upon academics, but just common sense. I'm a small business owner and have been my entire adult life. And at different times, there's an ebb and flow of business, and I have to make layoffs. I take myself off salary. Currently, 2.5 years, I haven't drawn a paycheck so that I wouldn't have to downsize people or wouldn't have to reduce their living wage income. So I, like a lot of other Americans who own small businesses, I have to be conscious of how to make proper choices. If I fail to make those choices, if I make incorrect choices, I have to suffer. Why is it that no one I know in the small business community, when the crash occurred, and we desperately could have needed use some help. The Federal Reserve banks, the money they give the banks to, were not interested in helping us at all. Concurrent to that are the 11 million homes that have been foreclosed on. The current 6 million homes are underwater in their mortgages, and yet the Federal Reserve could have worked with the president and Congress to have suggested ways of bringing the value of their mortgage down to the value of the market, so at least people could have stayed in their homes or not been underwater, or they could have made some other financial arrangements to drop down the interest rates and or to have protected those homeowners. They chose to do neither. So I'm watching trillions of dollars go to corporations that end up charging usurious rates on credit cards, student loan debt, that they, in the state of California, you can actually get arrested if you don't repay your student debt. And then if you miss payments, then you compound the interest up. I'm seeing people who have been charged on debit cards from these very same banks. I'm only referring now to the banks the Federal Reserve has a partnership with and gives these zero interest loans to. And I'm saying that it's all one-sided. If you're a major bank, if you're a major player, if you have a seat at the table, then you are dealt with in such a completely different way. You cannot fail. I don't care how ridiculous your business acumen and experience is, yet when you make a profit, you keep it. when you make a mistake, we the people pay for it. I'm concerned about that. And it's not academic, and it's not existential. For all the business people in America and for all the homeowners, it's very real. Your thoughts on this, please.
Okay, so the Federal Reserve, as an overall institution, which includes both the Board of Governors and the Federal Reserve banks, the whole system, is our least democratic branch of government. It is designed to be our least democratic branch of government under the theory that they need independence because politicians would want to manipulate the interest rates and the money supply to get reelected, goes the argument. And so they're anti-democratic and proud of it. They are also, as some of your questions intimated, dominated by economists. And economists have gotten almost everything important wrong for about 40 years. So, and they are heavily influenced by the University of Chicago School of Economics, which has gotten a lot of the stuff the wrongest during the
time. I'd like to that too. Anyway, I'm sorry, Bill. Go ahead. I apologize for interrupting.
So anybody who's worked at the Fed knows that regulation is at best a tertiary, and I mean that in the literal sense, it's at most the third most important thing they care about. At the Fed, everything is about the decisions of the Federal Open Market Committee. And to the extent it isn't, it's about pure economic research. And if to the extent it isn't either of those two things, well, then it's those folks that they don't really view as competent, the regulators. And they have almost no interest in what they do traditionally except to scream at them. So there's wonderful stuff in front of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And this statement, this like 24-page statement to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which your listeners can find free online from the FCIC, gives two classic examples of this. Again, the head of this was Spillenkofen, the head of supervision at the Fed for many years. And Spillenkofen says, explains how after the Enron scandals, the supervisors went to the Fed and asked to do a briefing. And they did because they found that these special purpose entities, which are precise analogs of the special interest vehicles, the SIVs, most identified with the current crisis, had aided and abetted Enron in its frauds, that they knowingly provided cover to Enron's massive frauds, and that this was most of the largest banks in the world that were approached, and that they eagerly, and as far as we know, not a single bank said no, and of course not a single bank turned in the people that wanted to commit these frauds at Enron. So the Fed staff briefs the board of governors and the top economists, and in fact, the top leadership does get enraged, but they get enraged at the supervisory staff for criticizing the large banks. They don't get upset with the banks for aiding and abetting one of the worst frauds in American history, right? So that's one. The second one is there were the thing that drove this crisis, liar's loans. So by 2006, roughly 40% of all the mortgage loans made in America were liar's loans. That means there was no verification of the borrower's income. And investigations have shown that it was overwhelmingly lenders and their agents who put the lies in the liar's loans. And studies relied on by the Fed have shown that liar's loans, the incidence of fraud was 90%, 90. Now the Fed, and only the Fed, had the authority under the Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act of 1994 to stop liar's loans by all mortgage lenders, whether or not they had federal deposit insurance. Right? So normally the federal government doesn't have regulatory jurisdiction over you unless you have deposit insurance as a lender. But the Fed was given this unique authority. And they, people went to Greenspan. Of all people, Acorn went to them and testified in hearings, and the NAACP, and all those liberalish-type groups, and the state prosecutors testified, and they said, you've got to use this authority and ban liar's loans. Greenspan refused, and then Bernanke refused. And then people also said, well, at least get the facts. Send the examiners into the affiliates of the bank holding companies. And the Fed has limited examination authority with regard to these institutions. And get the facts, because the affiliates, while they're not federally insured, are making many, many vast amounts of these liar's loans. Places like Aurora, which was Lehman Brothers, enormous liar's loan outfit. And Greenspan refused to do that. So flash forward a couple of years in time, but still before the, you know, before the Lehman collapse and such, and they finally get supervisory permission just to send out a letter, right? So it's just, hey guys at the largest banks, tell us, how many of these liar's loans are you doing? How many of these loans with piggyback mortgages, those type of things, right? These characteristics that we know are going to lead to disaster. And they get back horrific numbers, just absolutely horrific. And the staff has to brief the board of governors again. And again, there's testimony in front of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission from the guy, I think his name is Siddiqui, who actually makes the presentation. And of course, again, they got their heads chopped off by the economists and by the senior leadership of the Fed that didn't want to hear that the biggest banks were knowingly making and purchasing enormous amounts of fraudulent loans. Why? Because they produce record, albeit fictional, accounting income. You get a higher yield for loaning to people who won't pay you back. And that flows through with modern executive compensation immediately to your bonus. So the classic title in all of this is the article by the Nobel Prize-winning economist George Akerlof and Paul Romer, who's not exactly a slouch either. And the title says it all, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit. So the long way of answering your question in the real world is everybody knows that the Fed institutionally represents the interests of the largest banks, contrary to the interests of smaller banks, and distinctly contrary to the interests of consumers. Now, add to this the Obama administration, and the Bush administration was no better. But the classic quotation that has just been made public is by Borofsky, who was SIGTARP, the Special Inspector General for the TARP program. And he recounts a conversation in which Elizabeth Warren is trying to grill Geithner, Treasury Secretary Geithner, and get him to answer honestly about the mortgage programs you were talking about, the mortgage modification programs called HARP and HAMP and things like that. And finally, Geithner answers that he thinks, and you just gave a number very similar to this, that this is going to lead to at least 10 million foreclosures, and that the programs, while they're called programs to protect the homeowner, are actually designed, quote, to foam the runway for the banks, unquote. So when you have both the major organs that deal with financial issues, the Federal Reserve System and the Treasury, working on behalf of the largest banks, and the consumer can take the hindmost, then you get these kind of disasters.
I appreciate those insights. I noticed that you wanted to add something to this. William Berkman, will you add your thoughts now?
Sure, I guess briefly, I got a lot of respect for Professor Black, especially his work historically with the SNL crisis. He's a bit of a hero, but I got to differ with him on the University of Chicago. I think the perspective on the lessons that I learned from that place have a lot of validity in ways that I think he'd actually appreciate, but I could talk about that for a while. The other thing sparked, though, by his conversation that was another element of the problem that we've had in recent years that dates back to Professor Black's work back with the SNL crisis. In theory, we fix things not just after FIREA, but with FDICA, the FDIC Improvement Act in 1991, which theoretically set up a regime whereby the regulators would be forced to do what they didn't do in the SNL crisis, and that was to go in and resolve insolvent or failing institutions much more quickly, not allow them to gamble on the public. And unfortunately, though, one of the ways in which that regime evolved, including through international cooperation through the Basel supervisory regime, is in the capital regulation area, where in theory the Federal Reserve and other banking regulators regulate capital in order to ensure that we have a stable banking system. But they chose to do this in part by referencing credit ratings by a sanctioned few set of credit rating organizations. And this is a very important part of the crisis, that not to go back to one the ways that I was in hot water initially was I developed a proposal to strip references to credit ratings out of capital regulation in 2003 or so before the crisis started booming. I was concerned we were downloading our own responsibility and cementing the gravy train and the credit rating agencies in ways that helped them make a lot of money on the upside while they were, quote, foaming the runway, in Professor Black's words, or someone else's as well. But at the same time, effectively, that left the banking system so sorely undercapitalized, which helped them make money on the downside with effectively public capital on the behind them. So that's a sad state of affairs. That's another part of the story that we're talking about today.
One more question for you before we go back to Professor Black. At least 9 separate articles by respected investigative journalists, and we've done several broadcasts on this program over the years, is the amount of drug money that has ended up in Citigroup and other banking systems. No one has been held accountable. We're not talking about millions or hundreds of millions. We're talking about hundreds of billions over the years. And you would think that the Federal Reserve would be aware of money laundering. You would think that people within the banking system, because there's frequently friendships or they're on the same boards or they socialize or there are conferences together, would have discussed this. I cannot believe that in the last 30 years you have had massive drug laundering into the hundreds of billions of dollars collectively, and no one has been held accountable except for when they are caught. They're told not to do it again and given a little smack on the wrist, where if you or I, if anyone in this conversation were caught money laundering, we would spend the next 20 years in prison if it were drugs and because of the connection with the drug laws. Why is it the banks get out of jail free? Why is it their reputations are not held in the same disdain as if you or I or someone else committed an egregious act? Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think there are times historically where we've had the banks that were involved have had their comeuppance. We've maybe not the comeuppance that they deserved in part, but with the BCCI scandal and with the Nugent Hand scandal earlier before that, we've had instances where the facts have come to light and there have been prices paid by banks. So it's not entirely one-sided. And another quick reaction is that perhaps we should simply legalize drugs and help get away. But if, as long as drugs are illegal and as long as income tax evasion is illegal, then money laundering enforcement, if you care about a rule of law, needs to be respected. And perhaps we haven't had the kind of energetic work by honest people that we, you know, certainly there are a lot of honest people trying to work on this area. It's not all one-sided. So maybe it hasn't been as strong as it could have been because of the money involved.
One more follow-up question, Mr. Bergman. How does it make sense to the American public when they are not helped at all on any level? I've just finished 2 years of traveling around the United States for a new documentary called Poverty Inc. I see people who've worked honestly and nobly their whole life. Their savings have been hit. Many of them have been fired in their 50s and 60s, and their jobs replaced by highly qualified, highly credentialed people from India and South Korea and other countries. I don't blame them. They're brought in here to work at half the salary of someone who had actually gained some seniority and tenure of sorts. And now those people are scrambling. At the same time, I see the Federal Reserve giving $40 billion or buying $40 billion a month of bad debt. All it is just a swap, in my opinion, when I looked at it, where they're taking all the bad mortgages from all these banks, giving them, in effect, a form of legal money laundering. They're giving them clean money, taking the bad debt. We don't know what the hell's going to happen to that. There's no real transparency on that. No one has had them account for all the toxic assets they've taken on. And yet, if you or I were in business and we had that debt, no one's going to forgive it. No one's going to clean it up and give us new cash to start over. Now, add to that part, too. If the banks that are too big to fail would then reinvest that money in helping with mortgages, credit cards, especially student credit card debt, to bring down and forgive the interest payments and allow them a chance to make their payments according to what they're doing in life. Right now, when you're out of college, they don't care if you can't find a job. They don't care if you're working $5 an hour at McDonald's. All they care about is you pay the debt back to us. We're compounding the interest on it. Yet they got their money for zero. And they don't have to have the same accountability to the Fed as the student has to them. Now, they run out there and buy derivatives. They're investing in credit default swaps. I have seen figures from at least three separate economists. Those derivatives worldwide now are over $600 trillion. The top five banks in the United States that have gotten the most money from the Federal Reserve in that secret bailout, they're holding the highest positions in these derivative positions. Yet no one discusses that. What if that goes south for them? What if that doesn't work for them? Are we then going to have to bail them out again, where we don't get anything and we bail them out? How responsible is that? And then argue with me in my eyes right now why I should be a person responsible for the gambling debt of an out-of-control megalomaniac heading a bank like Goldman Sachs or some of these other people when they've never owned a small business. They've never worked in a small business. These clowns couldn't last a month in business on their own, but they have no problem writing checks for billions of dollars. I'm angry about this, sir, and I'd like you to directly answer me.
Well, you've raised about 10 or 12 different issues that are worthy of addressing, and I'm happy that the fact that you're simply, the anger is something that's very productive, I think, and we need more discussion of these issues. Going down the road, I think one thing that we could, that would help us in addressing these issues, you'd mentioned the expansion of the balance sheet and the mortgage-backed securities that the Federal Reserve is buying, to what extent we really know or don't know that they're paying a valid price for those securities is an important question. And historically, the Federal Reserve's monetary policy operations have been insulated from scrutiny of audit by the Government Accountability Office or the Congress. But that's something that could be changed by legislation that is currently passed the House and before the Senate. And that's one thing to perhaps support if you're interested in learning more about the Federal Reserve's conduct of its monetary policy going into the crisis and through the crisis and even today, then that's one vehicle you can use to help you understand what is going on behind the scenes. But having said that, I know one of the things, your anger as a small businessman looking at the favors and the unlevel playing field, the free market really isn't operating. And that's one thing that we could try to help instill is reduce all the guarantees that the big banks are, that we've given to them through our Congress, and in turn allow a more of a free market solution to the problems that we've had in recent years evolve. Sadly though, one of the most ironic things that have come out of this crisis is the fact that we've had a loss of confidence in capitalism when it really wasn't capitalism that got us into this problem in the first place. The problem has been the role of government in extending these guarantees and managing the guarantees. And as a consequence, capitalism has been given a bad name when it doesn't deserve it. In fact, you know, it relates to your first question off the bat. I'm thinking about what the Federal Reserve is. Is it private or public? A lot of people, I think, mistakenly believe that it's a private entity, and that's the root of the problem. In fact, it's a very public entity and very accountable. Congress could disband the Fed tomorrow if it wanted. That's not a private entity. But having said that, that doesn't mean that the fact that it is a public entity is the source of the concern, because we've learned that the public entities can be corrupted. And I think that's the root of the problem, is that our public entities have been corrupted by not just large banks, but special interest groups generally, including people that were trying to get loans for small businesses and poor credit quality borrowers. So there's a lot of blame to go around, and sometimes we have to look in the mirror maybe and blame ourselves too.
I appreciate your answers. Thank you. I do have concern when I'm told that these banks must have the money or the whole economy slips over the cliff, and at the same time I see them getting their stock prices stable so that their investors don't lose any money. They're buying up their competitors who are not as strong using that money, and they're gambling in the marketplace. Then I have to ask, then why couldn't they have gone through a structured bankruptcy to dispel and displace all that and eliminate all that debt that they carried? And whoever was participating in that debt, like anywhere else in the true capitalist system, must accept that as part. Otherwise, it's not a true capitalist system. There's no real risk. And so there is not a level playing field. But I appreciate your answer. Thank you. And we do have to look in the mirror. Professor Black, I'm concerned, as many are, that we believe we can print any amount of money, and as long as we're the United States and it's backed by the full faith of the United States government, that there is no consequence, much like our $6.8 trillion in loans that we have against other countries given as their currency. I don't think there's any real intent or capacity to pay that back. I don't see the unfunded, underfunded entitlements. I don't see all the corporate debt, personal debt, student debt, mortgage debt. All the debt in the United States adds up to over $120 trillion. Our gross domestic product is about $14.3 trillion. So how in the world do we keep this unique image alive that we are so exceptional in our financial acumen, and yet we are one of the most indebted countries in the world compared to our gross domestic product? And is there any point to where that works against us? Is there any point where the rest of the world switches over and no longer has the same confidence in the United States currency, possibly sometime in the future, the BRIC currencies or other currencies? Do you believe we run any risk of ending up having hyperinflation at some point, devaluing the dollar because of the reckless financial policies of the Feds and in cooperation with the central major banks?
No. And it's because we're not unique. What we are is very common. What we've forgotten in the commonness is because the Europeans decided to go to a very different system. So what's common about the United States with most nations in the world, and was common throughout Europe until they adopted the euro, is that we have a sovereign currency. And as long as you have a sovereign currency and you allow exchange rates to float freely and you borrow in your own currency, then you have spectacularly lower risk of default. So, for example, Japan has more than twice the debt load relative to GDP of the United States, and it is able to borrow money long-term for next to nothing. And that's the professional investors betting their own money, right? So that's what the pros are telling you in terms of the risk of nations with sovereign currency, and we're nowhere close to Japan. In fact, you'll note that Japan's big danger is not hyperinflation, but a continuation of deflation, which tends to be quite nasty. The problem is if cars are falling in price 3% a year, nobody has to buy a car, right? Or at least not many people have to buy a car, so they tend to defer purchases. And you can get a really nasty session going. Can you produce hyperinflation? Yes, obviously there have been hyperinflation. But it takes a real act of will, and it takes essentially a failed state government to do that. In the United States, we don't like inflation very much at all. We start going crazy on politicians if we have 8% inflation, which everybody on this, on this panel is old enough to remember. But, large swaths of Americans have never experienced that kind of interest rate. So the United States has a whole history over a swath of 250 years of very low interest rates. And we've done that while almost always running a deficit. Indeed, the key thing that people don't get is that a government, a sovereign government with a national currency of the kind I've described, is nothing like a household. But the thing we know, of course, is households. So when we think about budgets, we think about running a surplus as a moral good, and that it's essential, and that anything else is going to be the road to disaster, et cetera, et cetera. But that is nothing like the history of the United States. The history of the United States is overwhelmingly running deficits, and indeed, in the, I think it's now seven times in our history where we have very dramatically shrunk the deficit, it's been followed by six depressions and the Great Recession. Doesn't prove causality, but it certainly should be a note of caution. So back to some of the things that I think that we can all agree on to move forward, having listened to the three of us talking about these things. First, we should get rid of the systemically dangerous institutions. These are the things called too big to fail, although that was historically a misnomer, right? So in the old days, if it was too big to fail, we still put it in receivership. It just meant that we paid off the general creditors in full because of the fear of a cascade series of failures through the banking relationships, right? So if you had a really big bank, it's tied, and as you pointed out, with derivatives to lots of other corporations and institutions, and the fear is you get this failure that keeps on going through the system, and therefore you want to break it with this payout to the general creditors. But that payout, of course, means that if the creditors expect it, they will lend money more cheaply to these ultra-large organizations. And that will distort all competition. in fact, some very conservative authors who are at NYU, but are, you know, certainly from Chicago School of Thought, have said that it's the equivalent of bringing a gun to a knife fight, the implicit federal subsidy of too big to fail. Now, here's the good news. The institutions, the banks, would be more efficient if they were smaller. They are way, way, way too big to manage efficiently. As all their managers say as soon as they get in trouble, you know, oh, how could I know? Duh. You know, money laundering, really? How could I know? It's too big. You know, if it's below $100 billion, I don't even read about it, type of thing, is what you always hear as soon as there's a scandal. You know, and there's a scandal every 2 months at Citicorp and at B of A and such. So my conservative colleagues are always rant and rave about Citicorp having been bailed out three times during their adult life, and that is, you know, this should end. So here's what we should do. One, you can't grow any bigger if you're a systemically dangerous institution. Two, you must shrink within 5 years to the point where you no longer pose a systemic risk. We don't tell you how to do it. You figure out how to do it. We just give you the time limit. And three, during the interim, we will monitor you ultra-intensively to try to make sure you don't blow up the world through things like moral hazard and fraud and all those good types of things where you've tended to blow up the world. And even before that point, we need honesty. So the theory on why we have too big to fail, of course, is not that these are extra good institutions. Oh, my goodness, it's such a wonderful institution. We can't let it fail. The theory is that we have to bail them out because otherwise there's going to be a global crisis. But the administration calls them systemically important, like they deserve a gold star. So the first thing we need is honesty in our terms. They are systemically dangerous. That's the only reason we'd bail them out. Let's call them that, and let's get rid of them, right? So that we, because otherwise we are rolling the dice every day, and there are roughly 20 of these SDIs in America, and depending on how you count it, 25 to 50 outside the United States. So we're rolling at least 20 times a day, and if you consider the rest of the world, you know, maybe up to 75 times a day, to see when, not if, they're going to cause the next global crisis. And I agree. Let's get rid. I'm a criminologist, right? I mean, get rid of the laws on drugs. If you want to crack down on money laundering, get rid of money laundering. And you'll do that overwhelmingly by getting rid of the stupid drug laws. You know, our eldest son was based in Guadalajara doing this stuff. You know, for the Office of Foreign Asset Control, operating out of our consulate, and the type of job that if they snatch you, you know, that you come back 2 days later after, you know, your body's covered with torture marks, and you come back without your head. You know, so this is personal to us as well. This is just nuts what we're doing and what we do to Latin America. I mean, look at what's happened to Mexico and Colombia and other places as a result of U.S. drug purchases and inflating the prices. So let's go back to what I agree are some good economic things that came out of the Chicago School a long time ago. Milton Friedman said this was stupid, you know, a very long time ago. We certainly agree. Let's go back to the prompt corrective action.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's what he was. My colleague was talking about with this FIDICIA legislation. It said you must close these places down. Now that law remains in effect. It has simply been ignored by the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So let's hold their feet to the fire. Yes, let's audit the Fed. We got immense amount of useful information, and by the way, our blog is the New Economic Perspectives, the UMKC Economics blog, and it's our grad students who did the numbers on how big these loans were over the whole time period. And you can get that research for free
on our site that has all of the data analyzed for you and such. So let's go back to prompt corrective action. On capital standards, let's remember two things. One, capital isn't objective, right? It's a residual. Assets value minus liabilities equal capital. So it's easy to inflate capital by inflating asset values, which were done to the tune of many trillions of dollars, right, through all of this fraud. Asset values were overvalued massively, and we had policies that hyperinflated a bubble. Well, let's get away from those kind of policies. We had the absolute insanity of getting rid of underwriting before you made a loan. In addition to moral hazard, there's a principle of insurance and of lending that we've known for over 200 years. It's called adverse selection. And it says if you don't underwrite the risk, you will lose a tremendous amount of money, right, when you lend or you insure. And that's exactly what we did. And the reason that the lenders did it is because they reported such extraordinary income and maximized their bonuses. So let's fix executive compensation, which is completely perverse under every Chicago school theory of how the incentive structure should be. In other words, everything we know from economics says that your compensation should be based on very long-term performance. And what do we have instead? We have executive compensation based overwhelmingly on extremely short-term, and since the crisis, that's gotten worse, according to the surveys.
And there's a fellow named, another wonderful person named Ed Kane, who's a professor of finance at Boston College, and he's got some very interesting ideas about compensation, executive compensation, not just in the banks, but also in the regulatory agencies, to what extent the senior officials in regulatory agencies have not seen a kind of a downside in their own compensation. And Kane's argument is that we should have the possibility of a downside in their compensation if a crisis develops on their watch. And that's something that Congress could consider today if they wanted to, just reacting to Professor Black.
Well, the final thing here...
Yeah, it's so asymmetrical is the problem. I mean, you cause $1 trillion in losses and they take away $50,000 from you.
Yeah.
So your listeners can go onto the web and see all they need to know about regulation in this crisis by looking at the 2003 annual report of the FDIC. And you can see that they were so proud of this image that they put it in, and it's obviously staged for symbolic purposes. So it's got Gillerin, the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision, holding a chainsaw. He's standing next to the three leading bank lobbyists in America with huge pruning shears, and the guy who will be a successor as head of the Office of Thrift Supervision, which, by the way, was supposed to regulate Countrywide, WaMu, IndyMac, three of the largest liar's loans originators in the world. And they are all poised and posed over a pile of federal regulations. And if it's not clear enough, the pile of regulations is tied up in red tape. And so this is, of course, to symbolize that they will work hand in glove with the industry to destroy regulation, and that it's not going to be a surgical assault because, a chainsaw is a precision cutting instrument.
Gentlemen, we're at the end of our program. Again, William Bergman's website is truthinaccounting.org. William Black's book is The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, How Corporate Executives and Politicians Looted the S&L Industry. And I thank you both for sharing some very provocative and important insights on our program today.
Well, nice to be here, Gary. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you both. I've learned a lot.
Thank you. I'm Gary Nall. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much. We look forward to sharing more on our next program.